Hello, everyone. It's Tom Lin, and I have the distinction of speaking with the inimitable John Stepling today. And we're going to be taking up again a theme that we've been, a constellation of themes, the relationship between the technologies of our time. And, you know, we can go so many directions with that, but we can also look at aesthetics and the relationship of artistic and cultural formation as opposed to production, right? We can maybe interrogate that distinction. I don't know. And the manner in which technologies ramify for those processes. You know, again and again, and then, you know, maybe you can build from this, John. When I run up against people who are enthusiastic about the deployment of digital modalities for artistic production, whether in a general way through things like Photoshop or whatnot, or in these newer ways through, I always want to say so-called AI, because it's not intelligent. Like, if you just allow an understanding of intelligence to arise in your consciousness, you realize that these structures are incapable of exhibiting actual intelligence. But there's an effort to treat this phenomenon as essentially novel. However, when I look at Walter Benjamin's essay, The Work of Art in an Age of Mechanical Reproduction, I have difficulty finding what's changed. Doesn't, you know, I'd be like, so like, Benjamin realizing just the capacity to replicate images and so forth en masse induces a displacement from the concrete. And I don't see that we've really gone so far beyond what he was identifying with his analysis, but maybe you can build on that, or maybe you have the distinction between, let us say, mechanical and digital production or reproduction.
Well, you've introduced about a half dozen topics there. No, it's very good.
Go with what you feel.
Yeah, no, because they all interconnect and they all overlap, and you can't really discuss one without the other. But let's begin with, since you mentioned Benjamin's article, and that's become a very well-known piece, Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. It's on a lot of reading lists, syllabi in different universities. I suspect it's taught badly often, but because Benjamin's very difficult, and it's very hard to read a single essay of Benjamin separate from a larger body of his work and his historical place and relationship to the other Frankfurt thinkers, to Scholem, to a lot of people. And in any event, no, to answer your question very simply, no, I don't. On one level, we haven't progressed at all, but this raises a host of other questions and begs a number of questions. So let me put a pin in that, as they say these days, for one second. I was talking with Johan, who we both know, Johan Edebo, earlier today. We were talking with Uppsala University about this project in a series of seminars. And the topic of technology, digitalization, artificial intelligence, which you correctly point out is misnamed. And because it's an inescapable topic, it is a marketed phenomenon right now, AI. It's everywhere, and the chat box, GPT or whatever it is, has become a massive a massive investment, number one, and so it is going to be marketed, and you're going to see a lot of press about it, and a lot of hyperbole about it, and a lot of exaggeration about it. Artificial intelligence is essentially text prediction at a very rapid rate, and it's as such kind of remarkable, I suppose. But that's what it is. It has nothing to do with consciousness or sentience or thinking. And when you start to get, I mean, this raises this whole other yet third topic, which is this movement of transhumanism, and all the futurists and the people like Harari, who is predicting that we're going to have implants that read your thoughts and so forth. Now, here is a fundamental problem with this kind of discussion, because it vulgarizes the entire discourse. You don't read thoughts. Thoughts are not a scroll that exists in your brain that is constantly being unrolled and read or something. That's not what consciousness is. There's no thought per se to read. It's an absurdity, but it is interesting, because in fact nobody can define yet what consciousness is. It remains the great mystery, the most elusive topic in philosophy, probably. We have yet to resolve the mind-body problem or any of the kind of dualistic notions that you know, perhaps began with Plato, but certainly with Descartes and with the Enlightenment, and then we have to talk about the Enlightenment. But the point here is that artificial intelligence is not related to consciousness. That's not what it does. It's a computational device that has remarkable achievements, but it has nothing to do, our robot overlords are not going to take over the world and control us. All of that runaway AI stuff is, I suspect, just a marketing tool. It's hard for me to believe that anybody actually thinks this stuff is true, but maybe they do.
Well, I mean, I've encountered, sorry, go on.
Go ahead, no, go ahead, go
I
ahead.
I feel that it's more than something which is marketed. I feel, at least with respect to, I mean, the community involved with artificial intelligence in an advocating sense and machine learning and so forth, when I listen to them discuss the matter, technicians I'm talking about, not, right, you know, marketing gurus or whatever. And actually, I had a person who identifies as an advocate of transhumanism on an interview with one yesterday, just as a counterpoint. And they are invested sincerely in the project in ways that sometimes leave me astonished. Once you sort of like know the sausage.
Go ahead. Because you're quite right. There are people that are deeply invested in, but see, this is because this becomes perhaps the biggest topic we'll address tonight, in a sense, is that people believe marketing. People no longer can think critically and make those educated, informed, experienced judgments about what is marketing, what is real science, what in quotation marks. And this raises a question about artificial intelligence, in quotes, as ideology, as the reproduction of ideology. And that's a massive topic. But so I just wanted to say that, yes, of course, there are people that believe it. I mean, I think they're horribly misguided, and it's almost delusional. But But yes, they do. But please finish your thought, because I don't want to interrupt you.
Well, I mean, you sort of led into it with the characterization of an ideology. I'm almost tempted to take though I'm not that well trained, but to wonder if a psychoanalytic approach can be brought to bear here. You know, we use the word artificial intelligence, but these vital metaphors spring up all over the place when you talk about these fundamentally computational frameworks, right? We're talking about digital abaci or abacacies. That's what they all that they really are. What's lost is that their significance or meaning is the consequence of human interpretation, which is imposed from without on their output. But there's almost like a yearning to understand the machine as actually alive and having agency. So they've got neural networks, for example. They're artificially intelligent, and they learn. You know, even the notion that they're learning is to me, there's an incredible disjunction between the content of the metaphors which are being applied to these devices and the reality of these devices. So I wonder if there is a yearning to sort of surrender our own agency over to this system as a response to the sense of despair, which can be elicited by the overwhelming ubiquity of capital.
Look, I have written three or four posts, articles on my blog, specifically about the psychoanalytic dynamic with AI, the allure of this artificial intelligence, the obvious anthropomorphizing of it. The very name artificial intelligence is doing that. And I think there's very clearly I've written three or four posts about it, maybe 25,000 words about specifically this, and I don't have a real answer for you. I think there is a deep desire for it. Maybe it's as simple as a desire to submit and be done with the mortgage payments and the traffic jams and the bad marriages and everything else, that the long work hours, the economic precarity. Maybe people just want to give up with that. It's not an accident that Hollywood's constant manufacturing, creating of post-apocalyptic films and TV shows are always reconstruction dramas in some fashion, whether it's zombies or alien viruses or whatever it is. I Am Legend, I think, the Will Smith, that's perhaps the quintessential example of this, and the late Cormac McCarthy's The Road is a sort of elevated version of this. It's probably his weakest book, but probably accounts for why it's his most popular. But people want the fantasy in these reconstruction narratives, these post-apocalyptic narratives. The desire is to start over. People want the apocalypse. They want it all wiped out so long as they're one of the survivors. And it's very appealing because, look, these shows never deal with where does clean water come from and things like that. It's very appealing, this existence where you get up, you shower, there's a couple of attractive women survivors nearby, or if you're one of the male survivors, and you go out hunting zombies and you kill a few of them, and it's kind of exciting, and then you come back and you harvest the vegetables you've been growing in your little victory garden, and this is wildly appealing to people. I understand it. It's appealing to me too. The other thing that those films are about, just as a sidebar observation, is real estate. They're strangely aspirational narratives about real estate. I Am Legend, again, being, I hope that's the right title, I can't remember.
I believe you're correct, yeah.
Is about that once mankind is wiped out, geez, you could just go pick any brownstone on Washington Square and own it. You could go pick, you know, any house in Big Sur anywhere. This is very appealing. So couple that to the fact that also all the evils of the world have been wiped out, and we're starting over, and we're going to do it better this time. We're going to build back better. And where have I heard that before? The marketing people are not stupid, and Hollywood producers are stupid, but they're advised by a few smart people. So yes, there's a psychoanalytic relationship to this specific technology that has been deeply anthropomorphized and is presented as part of this strange, very science fiction influenced storyline that culminates in like Blade Runner and these sort of fantasies. It's funny that Philip K. Dick keeps having his stories made into films, because he's also kind of de-radicalized whenever Hollywood gets hold of him, but that's probably another story. But this brings up another question, which is science in a broader sense. And I know Johan wrote a piece this morning that was very good about artificial intelligence, chatbox, all of this stuff. Being serving to sort of subsume narratives of dissent. Everything gets sucked into this leveling process because there's no there anymore. And in an era of deep fakes and this massive computational capitalism that exists out there, notions of evidence and truth are ever more fragile. And so that's another, I think, factor that people have submitted to, in a sense. It's like, I don't care. I don't want, the truth is not worth the effort to find. It requires a lot of work, a lot of reading, a lot of critical thinking. It requires I develop my skills, my reason, and that's too much work. And I understand that feeling in a lot of people who are overworked and under assault.
There is a
go ahead. Yeah. No. I was point, just
gonna, and I, go ahead. This is going to seem like a contradiction, but it to what you just said. But I think it's a case of both and not either or. People also have been discouraged from trusting their, if you like, native intuition or intelligence. And to me, there's so much, especially in the past few years, which was transparently deception. The level of deception, which really, I cannot exaggerate. And some of it was so transparently obvious that you do not need to have known an iota of biology to see what was wrong. You just had to look at what was going on in your life. All right. And your own common intellect, or I'm speaking colloquially here, not technically, is sufficient to discern that you are being, that they're lying to you, all right? These are lies, and they're transparent lies. And people have given away trust in that native acumen to, if you like, a culture of expertise and professionalism that is, I think, incredibly hazardous, right? And also, by the way, it's actually not, in my view, that difficult to acquire a degree of facility in any domain, right? I'm not saying it's utterly facile, but if you take 3 months and discipline yourself, not that we all have, you know, the space to do that, you can learn an awful lot about what's wrong with conventional virology. All right. And so there's also this narrative that the experts have these commanding, almost godlike intellects and awareness of reams of material that is beyond you. And it's just not true. It's not true. All right. You can do that, you know, so that's not to contradict what you're saying, because that does take work to do that.
It's
like a both end, not an either or.
Yeah, no, no.
Right? And that comes back to the marketing, you know, people are.
Corey Morningstar and I were talking just today about this. That sometimes you sit back and it's hard to understand what seems so obvious to us, to you, over the last couple of years has still people still cling to these obviously false narratives, these obvious distortions and lies. And this was, of course, a problem on the left. World Socialist Web Page, Counterpunch, all these leftist outlets, people like, But people absolutely bought into the entire World Health Organization proclamations. They defended Anthony Fauci. They defended the lockdowns. They defended mask wearing. They defended the trauma that was inflicted on children, on the elderly, the destruction of national economies, the closure of millions, hundreds of thousands of at least mom and pop businesses in the United States and elsewhere. They still to this day will defend this stuff, and it's remarkable to me. But again, we're speaking about, if we step back and hear during this podcast and look at this and think, why did that happen? What were the mechanisms by which this happened? At what point did this abdication of skepticism and distrust of institutional authority, when did that just disappear? I don't know. Now, let me read you. I was looking for this while you were talking, because I quoted this the other day in a piece. excuse me. And this is from Guy Debord. And this is something from his comments on Society of the Spectacle that he wrote in 1985 as a sort of follow-up 20 years after he wrote Society of the Spectacle, roughly. So let me read this to you, because it's kind of remarkably prescient. Quote, "The vague feeling that there has been a rapid invasion which has forced people to lead their lives in an entirely different way is now widespread. But this is experienced rather like some inexplicable change in the climate, or in some other natural equilibrium, a change faced with which ignorance knows only that it has nothing to say. What is more, many see it as a civilizing invasion, as something inevitable, and even want to collaborate. Such people would rather not know the precise purpose of this conquest and how it is advancing, close quote. This is 1985, you know. So what we saw in the last couple of years was a kind of distillation and intensification of forces and tendencies and societal trends, historical trends that have been going on for a while, probably at least in their current form since World War II. I don't know. We can debate about that. Go ahead.
I mean, it didn't just happen. It felt like it just happened. Like when we were in the thick of it, but the conditions of possibility, which enabled that these past few years, this sort of consummation of these processes have been unfolding for decades. For example, I recently, like was it a few months ago, discovered Gunther Anders, who was writing in the, Hannah Arendt's first husband. He's not very well known.
Yeah, apparently I know.
But his essay, The World as Phantom and as Matrix, is this incredibly incisive indictment of what happens with radio and television, how it transforms our relationship with the world from one which is reciprocal to one which is unilateral. And the world then becomes something which comes to us in our home, as it were. And there's this paradox of how we have a sense of sort of godlike invulnerability as we now receive the world, but it's ultimately castrating, because it's not as if we then inflect these events which come in upon us. And right. Anders argues that this is part of a reconditioning of the human individual to reconstitute them to be the mass man, the mass individual, mass consumer. And it's dangerously effective. And he says, some people want to maintain that there's an inextinguishable soul, which is ultimately resistant. But he's actually dour on that point. He thinks that it may be a mistake to continue to discuss alienation, because perhaps, and he's writing this in the 40s, early 50s, we've already been so effectively conditioned that we can no longer be alienated. This is our very nature, to just be consumers of image. I would actually demur from Anders in terms of the extent of his dourness, but I think his analysis of the phenomenology, if you like, of what's occurring with mere broadcast media, leave alone what has transpired with the rise of the internet, is absolutely on point and anticipates much of what we're seeing here. So,
and it's interesting. Anders kind of has found a new popularity the last couple of years, and he's very good. And
he's similar to Du Bois, right? You know, notion of the
And look, you can go back and find and writing that anticipates the last, say, 10, 20 years. You can find it in some of the Frankfurt School people. You can find it in Du Bois, Althusser. You can find it later in, Steibner. All of the different people have Jonathan Beller, even more recently, has been very, very good. Jonathan Crary. There are people that are saying the same thing in different ways and approaching this subject
from different
perspectives. That what?
And also, I mean, you know, I don't know them that well, but then there are media analysts, McLuhan and so forth. And some
McLuhan was extraordinarily reactionary, but really valuable. I mean, I think McLuhan's a very interesting study. We could do a whole separate podcast on McLuhan because
I mean, I would like you actually to unpack that a little bit. I don't know him that well, but his name here and there, and
he's both right and wrong. You know, his conclusions were wrong because he was kind of an anti-Marxist in a sense, but he was certainly ahead of the curve on a lot of things, and he understood. He intuited very strongly something fundamentally true about media and the technology of media and how it was being disseminated. And he was the first person, I think, really to say it in the way that he did, that there is a sea change in how humanity looks at itself and its expression in this new mass culture that is electronically established, mediated. I'm always of a couple of minds here about some of this, and I should probably say this. Because on the one hand, we look at the last couple of years, which we both have just kind of touched upon, the you know, things that happened that were just seemingly unthinkable, and that so many people passively went along with it. Many didn't, but there were coercive mechanisms in place. People didn't want to lose their jobs. They didn't want their businesses shuttered. So they went along with it. At a certain point, peer pressure had a profound effect on people. I saw that here in Norway. Nobody wanted to be singled out and called a conspiracy theorist, that most feared epithet in contemporary life. So they shut up and they went along with it and they hoped that it would go away soon. It didn't, but eventually it has kind of subsided. So all of this is true. But on the other hand, there is a tendency, there is a tendency to exaggerate the changes, the fact that digital media has transformed life or something. Well, yes and no. Yes, it has, but let's not exaggerate. I mean, the world is more proletarianized than it has ever been. The nature of the class struggle is the same as it has always been. There are cosmetic changes. There are very specific things one needs to look at and adjust in one's analysis. But the values that are being imposed top down from the ruling class, the extreme wealth more consolidated than it has ever been, the transference of wealth to the very top was pretty much completed under Obama. And I try to explain to people, private jets never stopped flying during the pandemic. Most of the world's air travel actually is private jets. Those people didn't have to go through the same security protocols that you and I had to go through, and they didn't have to wear masks, and they didn't have to, you know, submit their children to these ridiculous traumas and alienate them from their friends and so forth. They were exempt. There's about a million examples of this. The people at Davos did not arrive wearing masks and social distancing from each other. It's all nakedly obvious. So the class dynamic never changed. This project was brought to you courtesy of a very specific faction of the billionaire class. And we could debate who that is exactly, but it seemed to me as if in the perhaps the first time in history, at least modern history, that we are seeing unelected officials globally in all these global NGOs and global bureaucracies and institutions exerting policy decisions on governments. And it was the suspension of debate. It was the suspension of due process. It was the suspension of transparency. Giorgio Agamben, of course, has written about this quite extensively and wonderfully. It was suddenly government by decree. And as Jacinda, what's her name? Former New Zealand Prime Minister, said, whatever we tell you is the truth, nothing else is the truth. Just listen to what we tell you. That was the formula. And she said right. that. So
to things that, to that effect. Yeah,
So I'm just saying that there's an awful lot of hyperbole attached to artificial intelligence, and well, let's talk about science then too, physics, quantum physics, and so forth. Because it has a relationship to all of this, and it is the legacy of the Enlightenment in one sense, that science took a particular kind of direction that maybe we can call scientism now or something. It was married to corporate money, as was institutions of higher learning, universities, and it took medicine and physics and every discipline you can think of, it took them in a certain direction that was aligned with the interests of the ruling class and the people that owned everything and now own pretty much everything. That's all. That's like, go ahead.
To rehearse your point back so that I follow you, right? You are suggesting that whereas the digital has had enormous consequence in terms of our cultural space and life and what have you, what perhaps is getting lost in the shuffle of that transformation is the persistence underneath or alongside or in part concealed by that transformation. Mm-hmm. The existence of persistent class structure. And, what I would suggest is that there has been a transformation in class consciousness, both within the ruling class or classes and, you know, those subjugate to their dicta. And it's a bizarre kind of transformation because on both sides of the pole, it seems like the notion of the conflict has been erased. And this happens in two different ways. So most people don't really believe, at least here in America, okay, in a ruling class. It doesn't register as something which exists. Right?
No, I know.
Yes,
that's true.
There are rich people or there are corporations, it's vague and so forth. But the idea that there are a class of individuals who have a solidarity and a commitment to controlling the means of production, to use a kind of stodgy old-fashioned vocabulary, okay, to leverage their control, the means of production, so that most people are in the thrall of their dominance. Most people think that that's just crazy talk, that there is no such thing. That's an old Marxist fairy tale. Within the ruling class itself, I think they don't really even believe in an underclass anymore, at least not as human beings, right? Historically, there was apprehension. You're like, well, we got to keep the serfs in line or whatever. Okay, but now the contempt The contempt of the ruling class has risen to a point which I think is almost without historical precedent. I don't think that they see most of the human species as not even perhaps rising to a level of a slave. We virtually don't exist insofar as I can hypothesize what it is to like inhabit their minds. We scarcely exist for them. And this is sort of like, I think why some of the things that they do are so brazen is that they're just not even aware of the most of humanity as humanity. I think that this is something of a change. Whether that's significant or not is open to question. But I don't know. What do you think there in terms of my response?
Well, I think this is an astute observation. And one that I agree with and have made myself in a different way. I think that those zombie films, those post-apocalyptic films are really overdetermined, if we want to be Freudian about them. They're reconstruction dramas. They're also expressions of ruling class anxiety and fear to some degree that the zombies are the underclass, and they're not human. They're the walking dead, and they need to be exterminated. I think it's a sort of secondary trope, if you will, but it's there. And I think there's another aspect to what you say, because I think it's an important observation. And that is that at this point, 2023, nobody is exempt from the madness that has been unleashed vis-a-vis this massive marketing and media. That part is new. The saturation that you feel that assaults you daily, I think that the people that create that own it, suffer from it too at a certain point. I think the ruling class is both more miserable than it has ever been and probably less rational and more delusional than they have ever been. But I also think it's very factional. There's clearly a group of people that believe in depopulating much of the global South. There's others that probably actually believe in the official narrative of climate change. I don't know. It's hard to tweeze apart who is behind what, but there is this there is this accompanying, there's two things. There is this accompanying set of historical forces with a certain continuity that believes in progress and the perfection of society and humanity, that it will reach this place of perfection with everything solved and hunger and suffering and everything will be gone, and at least we, the 1%, will live quite happily. But there's a second track that runs alongside this is that we are in 2023 now, probably in the third generation of human raised by screens. And this includes the ruling class. They watch screens too. That in that sense, maybe there are robot overlords. I don't know. The ubiquity of communication by screen is hard to deny. Now, We're talking about the West, though, and this is always important to emphasize, I think, because if you look at, France or Luxembourg or Germany, something like 80-some% of households have computers. If you go to Gabon or Uganda or Paraguay or pick a place, the percentage of homes with computers is sometimes 6%, sometimes 16%, sometimes 10%. There is a tendency in the West to see things through the lens of white supremacy and through the lens of our own privilege in this global mental map that has been drawn. There are many places in the world that do not suffer this endless bombardment of screen information and accessibility and all the effects that may or may not be having on people. So there's that. But I think that in the West, in the United States, in the UK, in the EU, you are looking at three generations of people that no longer read, often can't read. I have substitute taught here in Norway a few times, and high school students don't read. I mean, some are very smart and very open. It was encouraging, actually. But nobody was telling them what I was telling them the day I happened to be substituting. They were hungry for something. They didn't know what, but they don't read. They don't have any historical knowledge. I was teaching one class about history of the United States and slavery, Puritanism, the genocide of indigenous tribes. And it was pretty much news to them. And you know, these are high school seniors. They had a vague idea, but the particulars, they had no idea about. So that's what one is confronted with when we're talking about the relationship between AI, science, digital infrastructure that is upon us, and its relationship to culture, because I think this is a critical question. Where is the audience for the arts today? It's not the same audience as when I was directing and writing and producing plays 40 years ago. Those people are gone. They're dead. They're senile. I don't know where they are, but they're not going to theaters. People don't even go to movies anymore the way they did. And for example, the era of serious film art is largely over. That's not to say there aren't good films being made, but few and far between. And the culture for it doesn't exist anymore. Now, I taught at the Polish National Film School, international school, famous school, for like 6 years. And I can tell you very few students went to that school because they wanted to be Antonioni or Fassbinder or pick a great director. They wanted to have successful careers, and if that meant directing TV commercials, that was okay too. It was a career opportunity. So it was hard to talk to those students about why an Antonioni was important, why we could argue whether he was or not, the importance of his film. But there, you know, Bresson, anybody, it wasn't part of their worldview. And this, I think, is a critical part of things. So you have the rise of AI and chatbots and stuff. And there's a writer's strike in Hollywood now, right? And because it essentially become a gig economy for writers, and the strike was overdue. But studios are investing in chatbox, GPT, whatever it is, to write scripts. They see this as a perfectly reasonable investment and possibility, because I think they understand that that's what they've been telling screenwriters for 20 years, is to write like chatbox. So now they can actually get the real chatbox, and they can cut out the middleman. So these are all things that I think I have no answers to. But I think
I don't know if anyone has like an answer to it, right? I mean, I take hope in, I draw a certain jaded hope from the fact that a large part of the world is not completely subject to this saturation. But it's a jaded and a qualified hope, because it's creepy. And these technologies have an incredibly addictive power.
Let's hope
that those spaces can somehow resist the influx of these digital opiates, right? It's are you talking about reading? And like, what is it to really read? Like, even when I mentioned Benjamin in the beginning, you say, well, it's difficult to read Benjamin. Like, you can't just pick up a work of Benjamin and just read it one off. You have to have a sense of, you know, his whole corpus. And he's not the only author like that. It's really, like, you could look at Ivan Illich, you know. You can't really just read one work by Ivan Illich. There's late Illich, early Illich. They have a relationship.
Right, absolutely.
You know, I mean, whatever. The examples are legion. Okay, and that requires a relationship with the material, which is inimical to how we generally now encounter text, which usually is through the internet. And it's almost like fascinating how the internet changes our relationship with texts, where you always have the links and the hyperlinks, right? So you can't just like read, and then there's a link and you go to the link. You're like, there's this like fracturing of the process. It's destabilizing. Yeah. And this fracturing is destabilizing, I think, is fundamentally corrosive. It affects our relationship with everything. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there is that second point of hope that the ruling classes don't escape the effect of this technology. They themselves are also compromised by their involvement with it. And probably to even higher degree than the average individual, who is still embedded within the sphere of proletarian engagement. Okay, so.
I think that's true. I think the ruling class
leveraged as a point of resistance, if you want to think tactically, right? You got to return to the analog. The analog is the front of resistance. But
yeah, it's interesting. You know, I have said that very thing, that I think the effects of the internet, of the all these platforms, social media, the effects of that whole enterprise has been much greater for the people who own it, the 1%, than it has been for everybody else. I can't really defend that, but it's interesting that you're saying something like that too, because it's just how it feels somehow. Now,
you can
in terms of reading, pardon? Yeah. I was just saying,
to supplement your point, like you can watch some of these talks that they give at their summits. I remember watching one. There's a WEF summit, and I can't remember her name. She teaches at Duke University, and she was talking about these earbuds that you can put in, and she was very excited about these earbuds that could be used to monitor neural frequency and the relative attention of workers, so that now workplaces you can monitor. And like the thing about, like, you know, she's so excited about it with no irony whatsoever. She didn't seem to have any sense that she was talking about a massively dystopic technology. It was just literally going to infect people's minds to make them more effective insects in the hive, right? She didn't have any awareness. She thought this is a great opportunity for business owners, especially at scale, to enhance the production of their workers. She was completely captured by the ideology of this madness and seemed completely bereft of any awareness that the, what she was talking about is anti-human. I'm sorry if I'm getting like exercise.
No, but it's amazing to me because I have heard similar things. And there was a speech the other day, someone was giving about a new technology. Same thing, these earbuds, and they will be able to tell when your attention wavers. And so it's really good for workers because we can get them back on track and focus on their job. But you know, this horrifying dystopian vision, and it was being pitched as progress. But I remember being at a conference about the legal issues around AI and whatnot, but that's not the point. Somebody was giving a lecture and he said, well, I mean, there are uses for androids, for robots. They can go to nursing homes and serve as companions to the elderly.
God.
And I thought, this is, you're not horrified by this? I said it to him. I said, because I find that horrifying, blood-curdling, nightmarish vision that you just described.
With Lex Fridman, where he was talking about the same phenomenon with a mathematician about the use of chatbot technologies to give solace to incredibly depressed people. I even heard that there was like a suicide. It was an eating disorder hotline that had decided to sack its actual team because they now had programmed the chatbot to handle the bulk of the call volume. And I'm like, how far gone do you have to be to see that this is just going? I mean, they even have to explicate what is wrong with that is an astonishment, right?
This is very much the topic, I think, that we are talking about this hype, this marketing, advertising of artificial intelligence in all its various incarnations. And it's being presented as a panacea to all kinds of social ills and problems, everything from mental health to unemployment to homelessness, everything is being cured by artificial intelligence.
And
of course, the fact is that these things don't work. The earbuds that are supposed to help, you know, keep workers attentive don't work. But as long as those workers believe they work, then they work, right? In terms of the owners of the factory, they just want them to work. It's like those old CCTV cameras that were fake, empty. They used to put up in stores to convince people not to steal because they were being watched. Most of them were empty. Didn't matter if you thought it was there. I think we are circling around this question, this topic that is at the heart of it all, I suppose, and that is what is so malignant, so destructive, that is embedded in this idea of progress, and that at some point that is what has to be overturned, because it's deeply ingrained in Western culture and Western society that we are moving forward on this linear sort of Christian path of progress. And, it is very hard to shake people free. It's interesting that Ted Kaczynski died last week, the victim of MKUltra. He certainly sounds less crazy than he did when he issued his manifesto. There is something very problematic with electronic technology as it has evolved. Again, Jonathan Beller is somebody very worth reading, Cinematic Mode of Production, The Message is Murder. I don't agree with everything Beller says at all, but he's, I think, essential reading because he outlines rather clearly how that evolution in technological innovation took place, how and why it took the directions that it took. For instance, cameras partly were used as a justification for the slave trade, for police cataloging of suspicious individuals, social control, etc. It's very useful to track that and look at the situation today with the internet, a military invention, of course, as we know. I have no punchline to this, but I think that's where the analysis should that's where we should focus analysis, is what is wrong with technological progress, what is wrong with the general belief, unshakable belief in that progress.
Well, I think the kind of paradox is that it actually destroys our relationship with history. We need to reclaim the historical, but to reclaim the historical consciousness and engagement and embodiment, which is that's to a better future, demands rejecting the myth of progress, at least as this myth has been enshrined within this sort of, it's this derivative, futurism, right? It all sounds so soap and water when I say it, right? Like, these are cliches. I know they're cliches, but I can't get around it, right? But, you know, if you have to say it, you have to say, well, we have to reclaim our relationship with our own bodies and our limitations and our finitudes. We have to live an actual relationship with other human beings. It's like, okay, yeah, well, that's, of course, right? That's obvious. It's insidious, right? You almost have to just have a faith in, because you can't, it's very tempting then to try and use the tools of the enemy, if you like. It's very tempting to say, well, how can I present this rhetorically, how can it be persuasive? And I mean, that's fine as a point of departure, but you have to be very careful, because otherwise you'll get sucked into the very logic you're trying to combat.
This is also a very astute observation.
You have something to have faith that just enacting this in your own life with the people, places where you are, will create a kind of,
it's probably even deeper and more difficult to outline or define than you are saying. It's not just that one wants to use the arguments or logic of the enemy of the system that one is part of, because of course you're part of it. We can't escape it. We can't step outside of it. We do our best to find a place with a perspective that is radical enough to have some clarity about what's going on, we hope. But we are living in the midst, over the last, I would say, 20 years, and certainly over the last three, four years, we are in the midst of a massive transformation in social relationships. And people are, what is it, one in four Americans takes antidepressants, some astonishing figure. We are seeing incredible rise in self-harm among teenagers, suicide in youth, clinical depression across the board. We are in the midst of like biblical homelessness in the United States, something that just there is a kind of collective denial about. People are buffeted and assaulted with these fears and fear-mongering, methane bubbles are going to explode, asteroids are going, there's a runaway black hole in the center of the universe, there's a new pandemic on the horizon, don't throw those old masks out, you're going to need them again, on and on and on. The marketing of fear is profound. And so that's going on. People are more alienated from each other. There's objective evidence of this. People spend less time in social gatherings, having dinner with friends. Teenagers have less sex than they used to. They are terrified of the other. People, because of partly the way the climate agenda has been pitched, people see humanity as a blight on the planet. We have seen the enemy and he is us, the old pogo comic. This was the beginning. All the overpopulation people came up with that and hammered on it for years, that somehow humanity is the problem. And if we just ate crickets and then could curb cow farts, everything would be okay. It's very interesting because what never gets mentioned is the US war machine, the single largest consumer of oil products, gasoline, petrol, the most, produces more toxicity globally in groundwater, land, everywhere, destroys oceans, destroys environments, pollutes everywhere it goes. US has 900 military bases around the world. They're all toxic. But I hear very few, if any, climate activists about the US military. You know,
the thing I would, unfortunately, we're running up against temporal finitude here. So we're up, okay, up in a moment. Yeah. Because obviously we're just like getting started. I just want to point out something else, which does not, in my mind, get enough attention is, there's two points here I'm going to try and make quickly as far as I can. Is one is that in my view, the narrative of psychiatry, and you can distinguish between, say, like the psychological and the psychiatric disposition. Okay, you know, this is the sticky wicket, but I'm going to say psychiatry, the biomedical model of human health, which is exemplified by psychiatry, is absolutely one of the most vile and damaging aspects of contemporary American and Western culture. Because what it does is it cows people into a sense of remarkable passivity. And I despise it. I despise it and reject it, okay, outright. And that doesn't really get addressed. You do sometimes, there are people who know who R.D. Lang is, okay, but this is deeper than R.D. Lang, okay? And no, you don't want to throw the baby out with bathwater, okay? But there's that.
Go ahead.
And then The second point regarding it is bigger, like you said, the U.S. military never gets involved, but also the notion of, and you sort of touch about this in some of your essays, right, that climate change, but the problem is that climate is like, climate change acts as an empty signifier. There's never a concrete analysis of what is actually going on. You're not looking at a specific factory, which is poisoning the water supply of a proximate community, for example. No, there's this ambient.
It's an abstract.
So there's pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Okay. Now, I mean, to be perfectly honest. Okay. I hadn't thought much about climate change until I was already, I feel, relatively disillusioned at the outset of the madness, is what I call it, of the past 3 years. I don't even like using that word that begins with a C. It already has too much power. Okay. But there are things now that I never would have questioned, which have been brought to question, like even the constitution of the narrative of climate change as well. Now, even I am like bizarrely in conversation with people who are my political enemies. Like, oh my gosh, they have a point. And it's like, you actually, you know, there needs to be like, you actually have to read the footnotes and see what's really being said. And that kind of goes back to what you're saying about how this actually takes a lot of work and that's not very appealing, but those are like my two concluding points there.
Let me just, a final thought, because this is something I have written about as much as anything else over the last 20 years. First of all, there's a great book called Social Amnesia by Russell Jacoby. And I met Russell a couple of times. He teaches sometimes. He's getting old now at UCLA. Social amnesia is what happened to psychoanalysis from that radical political Vienna circle around Freud to when it crossed the Atlantic to the United States and became adjustment therapy, lost all political dimension, all radical dimension, and then was medicalized and turned into this pharmacological, biomedical, neurobiological discipline. And what it did was the idea established very quickly in the US was that therapy, the self-help culture, psychiatry was there to make your life work better. In other words, adjust to the madness. And you won't get fired from your job and all will be good, and we'll give you some medication so that you don't feel anything in the meantime. That's what happened to it. There's wonderful, terrific early work by a lot of the people that were around Freud. You have to kind of dig it up and so forth, and Marcuse's book on him, and then people like Norman O'Brien and so forth. But Jacoby's book is the best, clearest outline of the depoliticizing and neutralizing of psychoanalysis. And I encourage everybody to get it. And in terms of climate, the problem for me, because you're right, the problem is that it became this abstraction. It became cultic almost. And I have a couple of articles that I have written specifically on computer modeling, because this is the insidious sort of totem religious fetish for much of the climate fear mongering. But we have computer models. Computer models are useless in terms of a global. I mean, you can't computer model the world. The world is vast. There's a little tidal island in the fjord here near where I live. You could spend the next 10 years trying to computer model this little island and you couldn't do it because it's so complex. The ecology of just that little island is infinite. The earth is a wondrous, incredible, and profoundly complicated piece of nature. And it is a kind of arrogance and hubris in in this misguided digital scientism that has created this kind of one-dimensional cult-like agenda of and God forbid that you question it, because questioning in general is no longer allowed. So that's my last.
Fascinating how it all hangs together, how even there you're brought back into the digital with the idolization of the computer model, right? And
yeah,
the map has become dominant as opposed to the territory. Well, John, thank you so much. I'm sorry I have to sort of
conversation. No, I appreciate it so much, and it's always fun. And this was greatly enjoyable. Thank you.
Outstanding. So hopefully we can do a follow up. Maybe we can
anytime
just
talk, you like. Talk anytime about you like.
So all right, yeah. I'll go ahead and end it here, and I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, great. Thanks, you.
Bye.